boys and girls, ladies and gents, welcome to another episode of the Your Brain Uncovered show. My name is Aya Tarabin, a cognitive and clinical neuroscience student and the host of this podcast show. Here, it is my job to be interviewing pioneering scientists and authors to tease out some of their most fascinating work. I'm inspired and excited to welcome my guest for today's episode, the amazing experimental social psychologist, Dr. Wijnard van Tilburg. That is T-I-L-B-U-R-G. His research mainly looks at the study of emotions in the context of decision-making, and he has a very keen interest in the science of boredom. Dr. Wijnard, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me, Aya.
Thank you. Boredom really has been implicated in a lot of different aspects, from everything, from traumatic brain injury to learning ability. It has been a very, interesting topic to study. And in this episode, I'm really looking forward to diving deep into the science of boredom with you, Doctor. To start off, I would like to ask if there is a universally accepted definition of boredom.
That's a good point. There actually isn't really an accepted definition of boredom, but it seems that scientists are slowly converging on a set of characteristics that they agree on. So it's often described as an adverse experience of wanting but being unable to engage in a satisfying activity, and this is a definition provided by Eastwood and colleagues. Mm. But it's sometimes more useful to think about the kind of characteristics that it has. So we know that boredom is unpleasant. Mm. It's a common experience. It typically happens when people feel that there's not much going on. Mm. And people who are bored have an acute sensation that what they're doing is utterly meaningless. Okay. This sounds like boredom is a very passive state, right? And nothing is engaging. But actually, some research indicates that that's more than that. There's this active side to boredom. So people get excited to look for alternative activities, look for meaningful goals that they can pursue. So at the one hand, it's a state that is associated with our feelings of deactivation, and on the other side, it also prompts us to look out and seek for alternative things.
Nice. So there's the bright side and there's the little dull side that everyone, characterizes boredom with. So it seems to be a specific mental state that, people find unpleasant, but it's associated, with a lack of stimulation that leaves people feeling, a feeling of craving for a relief. It has a host of behavioral and social consequences, obviously. Touching on, the cognitive underpinnings of boredom, what brain regions exactly light up in association to it?
Well, there have been some initial studies on the cognitive neuroscience of boredom, and what is often mentioned is that the default network is associated with boredom. But I'm not a cognitive neuroscientist, so if you excuse my slight lack of knowledge about this area in particular, I do know that this area is also associated with the exposure to repetitive stimuli. Mm. So there may be obviously an overlap with that and feelings of boredom, but it is very much still an area of research that is ongoing. It's not very well understood, the exact neuropsychology of boredom.
Interesting. So would we be able to maybe associate the amygdala, since it governs negative emotions, and the prefrontal cortex for decision making? Is that possible?
Yeah, that's quite possible. Boredom features things like issues with attention regulation. It's obviously a negative affective state, and some researchers, including myself, would indeed call it an emotion. So it's possible, it's likely. But there's still, it's a very new topic, or at least relatively new experiments on boredom are very few, especially ones that look at cognitive neuroscience patterns. So I think the question is still out there, exactly what the neural profile is of boredom.
Interesting. There's a lot to be uncovered then. I'm very, very curious to know, what is it that we have this constant necessity to seek out change in our surroundings? I mean, does boredom really serve an evolutionary purpose in any way?
I think there's a consensus emerging that boredom is not just an unpleasant state that people should at all cost avoid, but that there is indeed some function to it. Whether that's evolutionary or otherwise is of course difficult to say, because it's difficult to look exactly back at the origins of specific experiences, but there does seem to be a psychological function to it. So for example, boredom is associated with seeking for more meaningful activities or more challenging situations, and that might be quite helpful. For example, in steering us towards new discoveries or learning new things. when the current environment is not stimulating enough. So certainly in that area, it may be advantageous to every now and then at least feel bored.
Nice. So boredom kind of seems to elicit, you know, imaginative thoughts and fulfill the evolutionary advantage of, you know, adapting to our surroundings. And where does creativity come here into play? Because I've read a lot of research about, you know, the links between creativity and boredom. So are we able to harness that potential in any way possible?
The answer to that is not entirely clear. So on the one hand, we know that boredom really does have a lot of negative consequences, especially when it's chronically experienced. It's associated with aggression, depression, substance abuse, excessive risk taking. Actually, the list goes on and on of the problematic behaviors, especially associated with long-term boredom. We have some insights into short-term boredom. So for example, boredom that we experimentally induce in the lab.
Yes.
And there we also find some negative consequences. So for example, boredom, momentarily being bored, is associated with more negative views of members of outgroups.
Right.
But there are some indications that it might be more positive. And one of them, there's one set of experiments, not by myself, but by Sandy Mann and colleagues who have looked into creativity research, and they found indeed that induced boredom can elevate creativity. This is still very little research. There are only a few studies on this, and I think it's important to highlight that while that is promising,
yes.
It doesn't mean that someone is turned into a Picasso just because they're bored. It might be one of the many factors that can help us sometimes to find some creativity where otherwise it might have been lacking. Right? But it should be considered in light of the fact that boredom is also potentially a negative factor in our lives.
Of course. So yeah, boredom can foster creativity, but not necessarily. And it does vary to certain degrees, as I understand from here. And so as far as I can see, Professor Gertz and a team of researchers, they kind of classified boredom to five different types. And I just wanted to know, what are they exactly? And do different people experience different types depending on their personality?
Well, at the heart of their research, what they looked at is whether it's possible for boredom to be experienced as a relatively more positive thing.
All right.
And whether it's possible to experience boredom both in situations that are understimulating, so where there's nothing happening, as well as situations that are overstimulating, so there's an enormous amount happening.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that they looked at educational contexts in particular. So more recently, I think, their findings allude to that, but also other people's findings have indicated that that boredom is not necessarily a low arousal state, which I think is what I certainly always assumed, and I think that many people
yes.
probably assume that boredom is false low arousal. It looks like it might be a bit more complicated than that. And one of the suggestions they make, which is quite interesting, is that perhaps the fact that boredom may sometimes feature low arousal, sometimes features high arousal, may indicate that while people are bored, there may be a process going on that, say, starts with low arousal. People realize that what's going on is not very interesting, but that slowly over time changes, perhaps accompanied by the search for more other activities that is more, more active engagement. So as I mentioned, it's a very much an emergent area of research, but this particular idea that boredom might occur both in context of low arousing and high arousing environments, that suggests that either there might be multiple types, or it might be that boredom is something that is more dynamically changing over time than we might have thought.
All right. So what you kind of link back here, you've previously explored the experiential content of boredom. May you kindly elaborate on that? So what do people exactly experience when they are bored?
Well, it's not uncommon to characterize boredom as an emotion. And the reason for that is that when people are bored, there's a common set of experiences, cognitive, subjective behaviors that tend to co-occur, not in all cases and invariably so, but generally. So for example, when people are bored, then cognitively, they're very much thinking about the fact that the situation doesn't offer any challenge, they may start reflecting on the absolute lack of meaning that their task is. We know that boredom is associated with attention failure, so yes. Fail to attend to what's going on. They feel like time is slowing down, so that's the cognitive side of it. Subjectively, people who are bored feel bad. They don't like feeling bored, right? It's an unpleasant experience. Not as unpleasant as, say, being, you know, terrified, but it is nonetheless overall unpleasant. Behaviors associated with it are fidgeting behaviors, stepping fingers, turning around, things like that, and looking for, you know, trying out different alternative behaviors. It's also quite easy to recognize boredom, I think.
Okay.
I'm teaching a lot of statistics, and as will be no surprise to listeners, you know, students tend to be a bit bored during statistics classes on average, right? So what does it look like? Well, if people are sitting down, you see, you know, they put their head on their hand, there are very few bodily movements, they stay quite still, seem a bit lethargic, they look absent-minded. So there are all these different characteristics that a boredom experience has.
Interesting. So practically, you're relating boredom to emotions in a way where it's like sadness, anger, frustration, these stuff that we experience when we're in a state of boredom, they're not merely just like a reflection of a co-occurrence. It's a part of it. It's a fundamental base of it, is it?
So we would see boredom as something that can be distinguished from other states. So obviously, you know, say sadness and anger are also unpleasant, but moments that are sad or anger inducing are not necessarily boring. And we've conducted research where we asked people both to what extent they think that these emotions are the same, but also we looked at context, to what extent the same one context can give rise to a different type of emotions. And we find that boredom is quite distinct overall from these other states. So while there may be some elements shared with sadness and frustration or anger, it is sufficiently different from those.
Interesting. So, I mean, we see here that a lot of factors are coming into play. And, you know, from your studies, it shows that the interpretation of boredom is kind of distinct from the measurement of boredom. So what type of tests do you conduct to measure it exactly?
Well, the nice thing about boredom is it's actually fairly easy for people to introspect, right? People who are bored, they know it. So a very simple thing is just to ask them. I mean, you know, we use just a simple Likert scale where we ask people how bored they are, and they're not shy about reporting it. Now, I must admit here that most of my research, what we do is we use experiments. So we make people really, really extremely bored and compare that to a control. So it's very easy to pick up that they are. Sorry?
How do you do so exactly? Very curious.
We have a lot of very mean strategies to induce boredom. So you know, the psychology students may be familiar with you know, reference, writing references A according to APA style. Exactly. I hear from your reaction that you're not really keen about that. And you share that experience with many others. So what we do is in a high boredom condition, we might ask people to literally copy references, to transcribe them in detail, including all the punctuation. And to make things worse, we typically use references about literature on concrete or lawnmowers, which are not really topics that people are interested in. So that's one way, and we compare it to control. We have used management videos that are typically not particularly exciting, to induce boredom. So for example, one is a video that tells you how to set up a fish farm.
Yes.
Which is incredibly boring. The one that we use is very effective, or we let them do really, really dull, easy puzzles, stuff like that. So there are lots of different ways in which boredom can be induced in the lab, and it's very easy to get people bored. You just need a few minutes, and that's enough.
Well, with the APA, it sounds like a torturing method and a boredom trigger. But yeah, so I wanted to ask regarding boredom has been, you know, related to a lot of different factors, from creativity, as we touched in upon, and as well as self-control for some reason. So there are a lot of problems that are highly correlated with boredom that are connected to the idea of self-control, which include addiction, gambling, binge eating. So does this mean that self-control and boredom are a measure of the same thing?
That's a good question. I'm not I think the evidence so far does not tell us that they're the same thing.
Okay.
But they're certainly related to each other. So, you know, we know that from self-control literature that when situations are very taxing, so for example, they require a lot of cognitive effort.
Okay.
And they require you to be concentrating for a long time or they're very challenging, that taxes self-control.
Mm.
On the other hand, we know that situations that are utterly boring are also taxing in the sense that you know at some point you really want to run away from the situation, but they seem to be quite opposites to each other. So while over challenging situations tax self-control, so do incredibly dull and repetitive situations. But over challenging situations on average do not elicit boredom. So there seems to be some distinction between the two, but there certainly is the overlap. And there's research going on, especially by Michael Inslicht in Canada, that specifically looks at this relationship and including the cognitive mechanisms behind that.
Interesting. So there's a reason to suspect that boredom and self-control do kind of exist independently, but there's not yet enough evidence to really understand much beyond that, is there?
Yeah, I think the evidence clearly indicates that they are related, but exactly how models of boredom on the one hand and self-control on the other hand can be integrated, that's still very much a work in progress.
Interesting. And you know, we kind of touched here on how various degrees of boredom kind of affect people differently and the levels of engagement. Now, can like over or under stimulation of boredom lead to more than just, you know, a dull afternoon, but to actual real mental health issues? Is that possible?
It looks like it is. So we know that for example, people who report high levels of depression or depressive thoughts also tend to score high on measures of the tendency to get bored. Likewise, there's some indication that eating disorders and boredom share some correlation with each other. There's quite a lot of work showing that there's a link between impulsive behavior and boredom. So it's difficult to test this causally, because obviously some of these changes take time to take place. You know,
yes.
Boredom may or may not over time result, say, in depression if not resolved. But I'd say at the moment it looks like this is very likely that if unaddressed and long lasting, that boredom may in time turn into something that's much nastier.
What about ADHD? I mean, it is all about attention and hyperactivity. Would their inability to, you know, pay attention be affected by boredom in such a way?
It sounds extremely likely that there is this special relationship. I mean, boredom and attention are related to each other, right? So boredom is associated with failing to maintain attention,
okay.
And attention wanders. So, I mean, it sounds plausible that there would be links with ADHD, for example. But I must admit that I'm not really an expert on that area, so I can't really comment on that. And I wouldn't want to say the wrong thing, but it's certainly an area that begs investigation.
Okay, so as it seems like, as a result, you know, feeling of boredom might affect someone with ADHD and have more weight on them than a regular person as compared to, you know, us and all. And, you know, for centuries, boredom predominantly affected the elite, you know, as the feeling it was kind of linked to a luxury, you know, to the working class, for you to be able to have the time to be bored. But nowadays, you know, with modernization of the society and all, and we kind of reorganize the way we perceive and process info, we seem to have all developed the ability to feel bored, you know, through the lens of modernization. How did that change, really?
Well, if you don't mind, I'll take a little step back, because I think what you're touching on here is an incredibly interesting topic, but also a very complicated one.
All right.
So first of all, the empirical study of boredom is, it has been around for some time, but systematic studies, including experiments, have been only in the last decades. But within philosophy and sociology, there certainly has been more attention given to boredom.
Okay.
And for example, in philosophy, especially existentialist philosophy, you know, people would take boredom as an indication that life can be utterly meaningless. But it was very much this existential philosophical experience. There's work in sociology and also literature,
yes,
that emphasizes that in the days of Dickens, for example, boredom was used as a linguistic device to describe how well off you were, right? Wow. So there's a famous character in one of Dickens' novels, called Harthouse. Okay. And this person was famously, declaring all to everyone how bored he was with everything, and tried a new hobby, tried a new activity, went on traveling or something like that, but it always left him bored. And this idea that nothing can take your boredom away signals basically status, right? That it requires a lot to make someone as prominent as you entertained. Yeah. But let's not forget that these are literary stories, right? But it might very well be that not just the elite got bored, but that sharing, complaining about your own boredom might be something that was more performed by the elite. Or at least if we based on literature. Aside from that, in sociology, it's described that, for example, in the feminist movements, that often by anti-feminists, women were described as being boring or bored, for example.
Oh, wow.
And this was used as a tool to make them look more negative.
Yeah.
Right. So and the same has been suggested that this has been done by, for example, stereotyping the working class as being just bored with their situation rather than deserving improvement in their condition. So there are a lot of political and social motives behind how boredom has been discussed in literature and historically. I think the idea that maybe boredom was something that was more part of the elite in the past compared to now, I'm not sure how well that holds up to actual, if we were to test that. So for it's difficult to go back in time to test it. But some of that might just be the way we have been talking about boredom rather than boredom really not being an experience that, for example, people from a working class background can experience. So I'm a bit skeptical that it used to be only the elite. Now you raise another point, which is really interesting, and that's the influence of modernization.
Yes, and
there are basically two lines of arguments here. So there's one that suggests that modernization will cause us to become more bored. And that's very much what Heidegger also suggested, that modernity ultimately leads us to boredom, which is bad. On the other hand, modernization, like having something to immediately distract you, might actually help us to avoid boredom all the time. So one could argue that it's the exact opposite. Now, there are studies recently done on things like smartphone use, and what we find is that smartphone use does help you to avoid boredom, but by having such an easy way to deal with your boredom, you're actually undermining your own ability to deal with boring situations where you are not able to avoid them.
But is that necessarily a good thing? I mean, using smartphones to and technological devices to just avoid the state of being bored. Is that necessarily a good thing?
It probably depends on context. So I used to live in and work in London. I would take the tube every day for an hour.
Yes.
There was no space. I would be standing there. and it was either staring people in the face for an hour long, which is a bit unpleasant, or checking my phone. So I did the latter. I checked my phone, and typically I would read the news or something like that, or check my Facebook, anything like that. I don't think that's particularly problematic in such a case, because there's very little room for me to, say, engage with creative outlets while I'm in the tube. I'm sure there must be something. Maybe I should have learned a language while there, or something like that, but I think it's fairly hard.
Yes, of course.
It's in other situations where it's more problematic, right? So I often think of the example of completing a tax return, right? It's an utterly boring process. Even if you haven't completed one yet, you can probably imagine how dull that must be. But it's very important that you do it. So in such a situation, obviously, having a smartphone that is there to distract you and take away your boredom, that would be bad. So it's really depending on context. And I think that's important, that people are mindful on where they allow themselves to be distracted, and at one point they really need to learn to just deal with that boredom and push through a little bit.
Yeah, so being able to sit with it and just be mindfully aware that it's there and I don't really have to run away from it is quite a big leap.
I think it's good to be able to deal with boredom effectively. I think that's the essence, right? It's important that you're coping, your ability to cope with boredom is higher, sufficiently developed, but that doesn't mean that you know, avoiding boredom is always a problem or always a good thing.
Of course. So I can see here that there are a lot of individual differences that we should take into consideration. I mean, are there any maybe key takeaway tips that you can leave my listeners with on how to effectively deal with boredom in any way possible?
Yeah, the best way is to prepare very carefully, probably. So, I mean, we have just come out of 2 years with various lockdowns and quarantines for some, and, you know, and boredom has been rampant. So how do you deal with it? Well, sometimes boredom is unavoidable, or you may not be able to anticipate it entirely. And that can be tricky because boredom is associated, you know, people who get bored get angry, potentially, but also it leads to unhealthy eating, it leads to impulsive behaviors and things like that. We know that, for example, during COVID in the US, that boredom is associated with breaking the COVID lockdown rules, things like that. So it can be problematic. But it can also be a force for good, potentially, right? So you mentioned creativity yourself. So maybe the best way to deal with boredom is to be prepared. If you know that you might be going into a prolonged period of boredom, then you know, make sure you have some creative outlets nearby. Buy some paper and some colored pens so you can draw or something like that. Maybe a crossword puzzle or something like that. But make sure you are prepared. So whenever that boredom hits, your only option is not snacking too much or breaking rules.
Of course. I mean, with the COVID pandemic and all, I feel like as it has passed, some people are still quarantining, and I think that's where the aspect of boredom seems to be very interesting. What do you do when you're left to your own, you know, company? What do you do with the time, you know, spent there? So yeah, for all you listeners, I mean, the next time you find yourself feeling bored, as you might be during a quarantine, maybe try to remind yourself of, you know, past issues you could not solve, and perhaps you might come up with a very creative solution. Now, I wouldn't really blame you if you're sticking to snacks to quell your boredom, because I'd be doing the same, but maybe after this episode, you can try a new solution or two. Try a crossword puzzle, maybe. But yeah, thank you, Dr. Wijnand. Honestly, I'm highly fond of your work for looking at boredom as a testable construct. I haven't been able to, you know, I haven't seen as much work as yours investigating boredom, and yeah, it's quite interesting. A lot of wisdom to be gleaned out of your words, so thank you for having this discussion with me.
Well, thanks for having me. It was an absolute delight to have our chat, and I hope the listeners enjoyed it too.
They definitely did. For all you listeners out there, I hope this episode has provided you with a very, very deep understanding of what boredom is and how it manifests itself in the brain and how it relates to aspects of self-control and creativity. I've provided a reference to Dr. Wijnand's most recent publication, and do not forget to let me know what you think of this episode with a review or a comment wherever you find my podcast. I'll be talking to you very, very soon. And finally, thank you for your interest in science.